Yeah, we'll use it.
Perhaps we can talk for just a few minutes about
nothing.
One thing and another, just to make sure that
we're getting anywhere.
Yes.
That had an enormous impact on my thinking with respect to biochemistry. And then it turned out that the book wasn't published till long after I was in the midst of biochemistry. And it's clear that that recollection of what that book did, must have reinforced things,
yes.
But it couldn't have initiated them. It didn't exist. So, in going back, I found a whole lot of things of that sort that were fascinating to me, and principally reflect on the inaccuracy of memory.
Yes. maybe between the two of us we'll get straightened out a lot, but I hope.
I made a I made some lists of the things that I thought had been important in determining what I thought and did.
Okay.
I don't know if you want to do that or if you want to ask me questions.
I think I'll start in sort of a chronological fashion asking questions, and then we'll go to your list, because I have a feeling that I'll gain a great deal more from your own personal thoughts than from my own questions. This is Leon Gortler interviewing Professor Frank Westheimer in his office at Harvard University on January 4th, 1979. If we could start with your childhood, and
I had never thought of starting there.
And let me, it has no impact on physical organic chemistry, but historians in general are rather interested in knowing where scientists got their beginnings. And so if I could ask about your father, Henry Westheimer, and could you tell me a little bit about him, about his education, his work, and perhaps the ways he influenced you? And if that fits in with childhood, I guess, in Baltimore, then tell me a little bit about that.
Okay. My father was born in St. Joseph, Missouri, and was one of a family of eight boys. His father had set up a whiskey business in St. Joe. And my grandfather, Ferdinand, had been a German immigrant who came to the United States as a young boy in the early 1840s. I could find the exact year, but I don't remember. And when he finally earned enough money, bought a ticket to the end of the railroad, which was
common for that,
which was St. Joe, Missouri. And it remained St. Joe, Missouri for a few years because of the Civil War, when railroad building stopped. And the Pony Express left from St. Joe. And my grandfather set up a whiskey business in St. Joe, Missouri, and his sons, including my father, were whiskey salesmen all over the West. After the eight brothers decided that they were ready for expansion, my father came to Baltimore with one of his brothers to buy out a company or buy into a company to make Maryland rye whiskey. And the other brothers went to make Kentucky bourbon. But they didn't like the state of Kentucky, so they settled in Cincinnati across the river, but their distillery was in Kentucky.
Otherwise
you couldn't call it Kentucky bourbon. And it made quite a difference which side of the river you were on. And my father was put out of business for the Volstead Act, and then went into the stockbroking. His education was mostly in the German-American high school in St. Joe, Missouri. Well, we had 1 year in a business college in New York. He was a damn good stockbroker. He was one of those who saw the 1929 crash coming quite clearly. He was a person of very high standards and few illusions. And had a very good quantitative mind. Some measure of that comes when I was in college in Dartmouth, came home my freshman year full of excitement because I was learning calculus and could solve these marvelous maximum minimum problems, and tried to explain to my father about them. He shrugged his shoulders, "No, I can do my minimum problems like that. No sweat." And sat down and did them by arithmetic. He did them the way a modern computer would do them. You know, just figuring it out on one set of numbers, and then another, and then another, and homing in on them and coming into the answer. And of course, it took him 10 times as long as it took to do it by calculus. But he could solve them perfectly well. The point was that when he had learned arithmetic, he had learned it right. He had learned it thoroughly. So he knew it. And he didn't know any calculus.
Obviously.
But he really knew arithmetic. And although that, of course, is long past my childhood, it's a nice picture of the kind of mind that my father had.
The kind of mind that you were interacting with,
I was interacting with,
right.
Yes. The family was financially quite comfortable in all the years I knew it. Just after the Volstead Act, there was a moment of crisis, but I was only 5 years old and wasn't really aware of that crisis, and the brokerage business prospered, and because of my father's foresight in respect to the 29 crash, survived, so that I wasn't worried in that way at all. And my parents, and particularly my father, were always quite liberal, is perhaps the wrong word, but liberal with me, in the sense that my father would have been overjoyed if I had elected to go into the brokerage business. But he put no pressure on me whatsoever, and anything that I wanted to do was for him. He took enormous pride in any accomplishment of mine. And wherever the accomplishment led was splendid as far as he was concerned. If there was family pressure, it was in two directions. First, that whatever I did, I should work very hard at it. There was no pressure to go into the family business, but there sure was pressure to work. And second, there was pressure for the very highest standards of integrity. And though I don't know that this is an appropriate thing to go into this history, and I may edit it out, my father pointed out to me how fortunate I was to be Jewish, because there was prejudice against Jews.
And the result of that was that any Jew who wished to make his way in the United States could do so, but had to work harder and maintain a higher standard of integrity than his non-Jewish neighbors. And that was the philosophy with which I grew up.
What? In good stead, I think.
Yes, indeed. So, I mean, it was his idea that a mild anti-Semitism was an enormous advantage.
Your mother.
My mother?
Her influence
was.
Her role in the family.
A third generation American. And grew up in a moderately well-to-do, upper middle class, Baltimore family. She was an absolutely beautiful woman, and was for her day a very modern lady. Now, of course, you have to know that her day was the height of the Victorian period, and it is true that when some gentleman who was calling on her grabbed her and kissed her, she thought she was ruined and no one would ever marry her. She went to Goucher College, which was relatively rare in those days, and graduated from Goucher in 1908. The number of women who graduated from college before World War I was small. She was smart and well educated. But she didn't do very much with her life, really. A modern woman would have done much more. She was a wife and mother. She took some part in building the child study organization in Baltimore. But she was, in a sense, wasted. Had a much better mind and education than she used.
What kind of role did she play in your upbringing?
I think the first thing to say about my upbringing is that I was an only child.
Okay, that was one of the next questions.
I had two brothers, both of whom died. I had an older brother who died of tuberculosis when he was 5 and I was 2 or 3. And I guess 3. And he was obviously, fabulously smart. And was reading fluently at the age of 5, which was less common then. And now, I guess putting in an awful lot of ands, I'll have to stop that.
Those were all coming up.
Since he was ill, the family attention was focused on him and not on me until after he died. And then my mother was pregnant and had
her third son, who again, who died in infancy, a few months. My parents had bought and moved into a house in the suburbs just as the Volstead Act was passed, and there was considerable family concern at the time. But everything worked out then all right. My parents insisted that I be quite independent. And despite the fact that I was an only child and they had lost two others, gave me a great deal of freedom. I don't know that it went quite as far as Jean went. When our daughter Ruth was 2 and a half, and Jean was pregnant with Ellen, she was having, I guess maybe she had had a miscarriage, and the obstetrician had put her to bed. And we put Ruth in the University of Chicago nursery school. And the first day she was going, I told Jean I thought I'd pick her up at noon and bring her home. Mm-hmm. And Jean turned to me and she said, "You do nothing with yourself. That child will come home in the bus with the other children. You can't go on protecting her all her life."
My, that's wonderful.
I don't know that my parents treated me quite that way. Mm-hmm. But they wanted me to be independent. Mm-hmm. And my mother read to me a great deal. But aside from that, I don't remember being clung to at all. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Really, quite the contrary. I went to a small private school.
The Park School.
You know it?
No. I just picked these things out of odd...
I sat for the years in kindergarten under the grand piano and wouldn't come out. The story is that I was trying to build a scale out of blocks. And every time I tried to build the top of the scale, it failed. It took me 2 years to find out that it wouldn't work and crawl out. I doubt that story is entirely accurate. But it was true that I was a bit backward. They kept me back in kindergarten, wouldn't promote me. And my mother was quite worried about me. Somewhere around that time, had my tonsils and adenoids removed, whereupon I suddenly blossomed. And I think I am probably one of the people who was actually being poisoned by diseased tonsils and adenoids. Mm-hmm. But maybe not. Maybe it was just time. You know?
Sure. What? Right. Right.
I have no idea. There's no way of going back and finding out. My tonsils and adenoids came out and I skipped the third grade. The causal connection is not entirely clear. And then was with the other kids in school. I've done that. It was an interesting school. It was a progressive school in which I failed to learn to read properly, read very slowly. Perhaps my children are dyslexic, and it's quite possible that I'm slightly dyslexic. It may be for that reason I read very slowly. I think it probably is true. I tend to reverse letters and reverse words, even today. Um,
My arithmetic is kind of sloppy. I never learned to spell. I've worn out several dictionaries. One of our famous, not famous, sorry, I didn't mean that in a bad way, favorite family stories is long after I was married, when we were living in a house somewhere or other, and I called upstairs to Jean and said, "Darling, how do you spell professor?"
I laugh because I have a habit of doing that occasionally myself.
So I spell correctly now most of the time, but I still have trouble. I use dictionary a great deal. I didn't learn to write properly. Now, when I say I didn't learn to write properly, I didn't write with the horrendous grammar that my graduate students. But I didn't learn to write the English language until I was on the staff of the University of Chicago, when I had my English lesson. You want to listen to that, too?
Sure.
It's out of time. There was an old man at the University of Chicago named Jim Senior.
I remember Professor Senior, and he used to walk around with a pipe sticking out of his
right,
mouth.
Right, yes. And his one suit, which was a brown tweed, with a button off the vest, and the vest always misbuttoned by one button. And the pipe was a corncob pipe.
Yes, yes. And he probably had the same suit on when I was there.
And he was a stickler for proper English. On one occasion, I walked out into the hall, and he was on his way across the hall to Karash's office. He was a great big tall man, I don't remember him, waving a thesis in his hand above his head and shouting at the top of his voice, "Morris, this is a wonderful thesis. Why don't you have it translated into English?" Well, I submitted to him the first paper I wrote at the University of Chicago. And I submitted it with enormous pride because I thought I could. I thought it was a good scientific paper. And he handed it back to me, and there was more red ink on it than black. And I was angry with that stupid old man for tearing apart my beautiful English.
Mm-hmm.
I was about to kill him, but I thought at first I'd read what he said, and I read what he said, and I got twice as mad because it was remarks on every sentence. And then I read his remarks over again, he was right every single thing. I had made grammatical errors. I had redundancies. I had skipped essential parts of arguments. I had put sentences in the wrong order. I had committed every crime in the book. And when I submitted my second paper to him, it was somewhat better. By the time I left the University of Chicago, I had almost learned to write English. And have had a few English lessons since. Now I'm rather pleased with what I can do. But I didn't learn at the Park School. The only thing I remember really learning at the Park School was algebra. I learned algebra the way my father learned arithmetic. I know it all the way down to the bottom of my stomach. And I can use it, and it has stood me in very good stead.
Yes, we'll get to some of those papers later.
I had a very good course in trigonometry. I was the only person in this small high school who wanted to learn trigonometry. They couldn't have a class for one person, so being a liberal school, they gave me an individualized course as follows. The mathematics teacher gave me a textbook in trigonometry and said, "Here, take this. At the end of the year, I will give you an examination called from the College Board test on trigonometry." So I learned two things. One, trigonometry, and the other, that you don't need anyone to teach you anything. But if there's a good book, and you're willing to work, you can do it yourself. And I had the discipline to do that, and did it. So that was helpful. I very much enjoyed mathematics and science. I had less of a working career than most kids. Those were the prosperous days of the 20s. There was no financial pressure on me to work. I had been to summer camps. I did work some summers. I worked in my father's brokerage office. As a board boy, and those were the days before the automatic tapes. And one wrote the quotations, there was a ticker tape, and one wrote the quotations up on the board. The dull routine job, and I did that. I had a couple of jobs doing bookkeeping kind of things for various firms in Baltimore, where I guess I got jobs with my father's friends doing routine things. But I think I did a lot less work than most kids my age, because there was absolutely no financial pressure to do it. When it came time to go to college, maybe I've skipped. I don't know.
Just a few odds and ends from there. You've covered almost everything that I wanted to ask. You said you read slowly, but were you an avid reader? Were there any particular books that, that appealed to you aside from the math and science? Remember anything?
Oh, I read a moderate amount. But they were the usual things that people read in those days. When I was a small child, I read through the entire series of the Oz books, which were coming out at that time, dozens. I read a very large amount of Dumas and Conrad. I would say that I read no more than other kids did, that was the days before radio and TV.
That's true. Okay.
And less than some. Dupree's Microbe Hunters made an enormous impression. I don't know. I wrote that down here, but I don't know that I got the date on it. I didn't. So I don't know when that came out. Whenever it came out, it made quite an impact. And my family had a largely impressive library. Stocked mostly with the classics of my parents' day, Dickens and Balzac and things of this this sort. Some of which, not really a lot. I didn't understand reading the way modern kids do. I guess I don't want to read that one, but I do want to get the heat.
Mm-hmm.